So with no further ado, I won't take up any more of their time, and I would like to introduce Jan. My name is Jan. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad that Pat and Bill got me involved, because I've been backing off because I don't know what combination is health or excuses. but he told me I wouldn't do it last year. Well, at any rate, I'm here, and I do have some strength at home pushing me on. That's Bill. No excuses, see. Any rate, I'm Jan, and alcoholism to me is something I'm glad I can put in the past, you know, and because here I am 75 years old now. And so I've had 39 years of sobriety, which is... That's what I mean by putting it in the past, 39 years of, staying sober. I had a father, which was very serious business to me, who was an alcoholic who drank till the day he died. And he was a little younger than I was when he died. But I never have gotten him out of my mind. Bill says, why don't you put him out of your mind? He really influenced me a great deal. When I saw him drink, Bill tried to get him to go to AA. I'm not telling his story completely, but, and he'd say, I don't want any part of that. Nah, I'm going to go down this way. So he drank till he died. And it was not a happy experience by any means when I was young with him. I had no confidence, no feelings that I could amount to anything. And thanks to him, because he brainwashed me with that kind of thinking. Well, I left home when I was 18. And I went to live with an aunt of mine. And for the first time, the only thing I wanted was some peace and quiet. Then I went and got a job and met Bill. Then the war came along. I identified with Rosa all the way on the war with the sailors. But the first drink I had, which was going to be nothing like my father, I wasn't going to be like him, and was right before he left for overseas. And I went downtown, and the guys and the people that we were working with at the bank all decided to go out, and we had a group of us that decided to have a drink. And no problem, you know, no problem at all. Well, Bill went overseas, and I moved back into the neighborhood I was raised in, and immediately found my closest high school friend, and we started heading up to the corner to the local little bar where all the sailors hung out. There was a school near us, a Navy school. Now that was just to entertain the soldiers, the sailors, just to keep them happy, and all of us happy while he was far, far away over in Europe battling the Battle of the Bulge and so forth. Those beginning days were nothing, but the first drinks I took, though, I loved getting drunk. Now, of course, this is going to be all fun and games. Nothing but fun and games, and that's the way it amounted to until, except any excuse, you know, in order to drink, you know. When Bill returned home, he found out I was an alcoholic, he was an alcoholic, and we didn't use that term, but we were drinking like that. And it was, I lived with my mother, then we had kids, one after the other. You heard that story before, one child after another. Everybody after World War II had gangs of kids. At the time, you know, of course, that wasn't all planned. But at the time, I thought having a family was one of the greatest things that could happen to me. Because I grew up so darn unhappy, and I thought a lot of kids are going to make me feel good. And the only thing is I found out I couldn't be too responsible for them. You know, they drove me nuts. Especially four sons. All going at each other, you know, right and left. And so here I was living in three rooms for 9 years five children. I had one daughter. But I couldn't wait till at nighttime to get out. Put the kids to bed, my mother was there, and out the door I'd go with my local little friends. Any excuse, you know. So I didn't realize I was using excuses to drink. I thought I just had to because of all these kids. You got to get down there where there's some adults to talk to or drink with. I didn't care for people if they didn't drink. Never got along too well with other people. I had no sense of security. But if they drank, it was great. You know, you could relax then and have fun. Well, along about this time, we moved out to... Bill graduated from college, and we moved out to a town called Park Forest, Illinois, which was a new subdivision built for returning veterans. It was sort of like there was one in New York area that was built like this. And, well, we're not going to drink anymore. We're just not going to do any of that stuff we were doing. So I sat there and rocked in the chair, you know, at night, and everything was so peaceful and so nice. The next thing I know, and then I begin to get lonesome, and Bill came home one night and said, "Hey, I got some friends for you to meet." It took me 2 seconds to get dressed and put my daughter to babysit. She was about 11 years old at this time when I started her as my babysitter. Didn't everybody? I had a baby, only, how old was he, Bill? Well, the last one was only a few months old, and I taught her how to get the bottle, get the diaper, and all this stuff. And then he was safe, you know, because he had his 11-year-old sister to watch him. Well, the sad things that happened right at that time, I was right over there drinking with him, but I can remember sad things happening, you know. Peggy later, she's 11 years old, she came down and says, "Yes, Mother, everything was fine. The front door was wide open, and there was the kids there alone." Since I got sober and everything, I came to realize that all the things that, with children, that I could have had real trouble with. I could have, you know, wandering out, when does a mother leave home and leave her kids? You know, things like that. And leave her with an 11-year-old. And the others were 4 and 6 or something like that. Well, I didn't think of that until I got in AA, you know, the trouble what could have happened to me for leaving them. And, of course, you know the whole story of drinking, that it always winds up in something real bad. As you think back on it from when you're in AA, you think back, things that you put back here someplace in your mind, or in my mind, you know, put it back here, it's never going to cause any trouble, but it could have. So for the grace of God, I didn't really get in serious trouble, which I should have. The last bout, you know, there's 2 or 3 that come out in my mind, you know, that I know would have been serious. The last was I met Bill's best friend and I was going out with him. Of course, Bill didn't know it. So I was going out with him and it lasted about a year, you know, and I knew I was living in some dream world that doesn't amount to much. I knew it. There I was going out the door, teaching my daughter. All of a sudden it dawned on me, I'm teaching her the things my father taught me. I'm lying to her. I had a hell of a time lying. It always would show all over my face, you know, that I was lying. It just did. It was hard for me. But every drinker has to lie sometime. But the last terrible event that happened, I like to remember this because it makes me appreciate the life I've had in AA, was the fact that this guy came over to the house in the middle of the afternoon and had something to drink. We were sitting there drinking and Peggy glowering at him all the time, you know. I was a friend of your father's, you know. Well, she was going to go babysit for another close friend of mine who was also an alcoholic. So we let her out the door to go babysit with him. And on the way over to our friend's house, a child ran out and was killed. And the next whole year was spent with her going to court. And she's just a little kid, you know, 11, I don't think, maybe 12, sitting in the courtroom, you know, about this, trying to prove his innocence, you know, that the child ran in the path of the car, which was the case. And a whole year of that. And I thought, I may not have been right directly involved, but somehow God shows us, you know, that if I hadn't been doing what I was doing, maybe this wouldn't have happened. Maybe that was God's way of showing me that I've got to quit drinking, I've got to quit leading this life. But I didn't. That was just on the way. But he went free, but that was the end of that little affair. So then I'm leading up to when I came in AA, which was very soon. We moved and got our first house. Bill had come in AA. I was not in AA. I was still drinking. I drank for a year after he did. And after he came in AA, then things really went bad. My closest friend who was babysitting, you know, all the time and going out, we both knew how to lie wonderfully. We were both, she came in AA, Bill was in AA, and gradually it was getting so I was the only one drinking. Little crowd. I never wanted to be alone. So there I am. I met a girl. Oh, yes, I got to get that in. I met this gal in an Al-Anon meeting. I started going to Al-Anon. I was going to help Bill. Do whatever they tell me to do. So I met her, and she's the worst damn drunk I ever met. And she was crazy. You know, I say, don't say that. Because I was always kind of timid, you know, and sneak in, you know, and do what I want to do, but don't make a big noise about it. And she came into the Al-Anon meetings drunk. And then I say, shh. I was drunk too, probably, but I could stand up straight. I could at least stand up straight. Well, Bill and her husband, who was in AA, sat and talked about us and said, what are we going to do about our wives? And it ended up that Bill says, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm not going to do a damn thing about her and me. And because he learned that in AA, leave me alone. Leave your wife or husband alone. You can't do anything about him. Well, that woman today is not alive. Thank God I came in AA. She wouldn't come. And she died drunk in the bathtub. Now, I'm not going to tell a long series of people I knew who died, but that was the case. And it was beginning to influence me. God, they're drinking the same way I do. Well, what brought me in, I was afraid. Suddenly, you don't know why, I was afraid. And things happened to me that never happened before. Like the main thing, acting like my father. And the second thing was up north, there's a lot of snow. And I was out there drunk in a snow heap. And this is just before I came in AA, and I was scared, and I wasn't sure what was going to happen to me. I said, you know, maybe to myself and God, or whoever was listening, I guess it was God, I said, maybe they can do something for me. So that was it. Fear is what brought me in AA. There's a changing point when it's no longer fun, it's fear. And so I didn't come in the way most people do, but I already knew some of these AA people. They were going to come over and talk to me, so they did. And they gave me a choice of what meetings I could go to. I didn't want to go to any of them. And they said, am I going to go this one, that one, or the other one? So I didn't drive either, because I had fears and I was afraid to drive. So that was the name of my game. I was full of fear. So they took me to a meeting, and the first time I know I just heard this. Here I'd been, I never listened, you know, when Bill was sober. It wasn't for me, but then all of a sudden I identified with the stories that were being told. I thought, that's me. All of a sudden I realized that. And they gave me, so I listened. And I was really afraid to drink at that point. I really was afraid of it. I said, I had a feeling it was going to be the last drink. And that now I'd like to, you know, just sort of tell you what AA has meant to me. I was so scared of everything, had no courage, sober. I had goofy courage when I was drinking. But sober through the years, AA gave me the courage. Where you have friends that put their hands on you and help you. How do you get through a day? That was one of the biggest things I heard. I didn't have to plan my whole future. Just today. I was drilled with that about just today. If I could get through that day, I didn't have to worry whether I could drive a car 5 years from now or whatever, or get a job. I didn't have to at that point, but Then on the courage thing, I did get it all here. I think God gave it to me in the time I was supposed to. When we were transferred down here, I had almost 8 years of sobriety, but I had never done anything except go to meetings. So when I got down here, finally I realized Bill started to travel. My life was changing. He was traveling on his job, and I thought, there sat the car. Well, that was the first thing I accomplished. I went to driving school and learned to drive. That was a big deal for me, really, to learn to drive. And that really brought about a lot of independence I never had had. He always had the car, I never had it. So now I had the car. Next came the jobs, you know. I never had any real, what you call, big-time job. I drifted from one to the other because I was not in charge of earning all the money to pay the bills. So I could just to put an application in at that point was a big thing to me. Here I'd worked, I met him at the bank, and I had worked when I was young for a year or two, a couple of years. But to do that was the first step of courage. Also, they told me when I left to go to meetings. When you get down to Atlanta, go to meetings. And I was so mixed up because I had never moved. Never. I lived in one area. So I went to meetings, constant meetings, and I had never done that either. The program I had up there, they didn't make us go to a lot of meetings. I didn't have to, we had no treatment centers. We had none of that. It was just a neighborhood AA program at our meetings. So I learned a different way of AA programs down here, entirely different. But I basically, in my thinking, have kept what I heard in the beginning, which was stay close to the program. Stay close and get a friend or two, which I finally found. It happened to be a girl from back home, and I stayed close with her, and we shared every feeling and thought we had. So since then, it has grown. It has become very, very strong to me. As far as the family is concerned, as they grew and everything got fine, much better. But then my youngest son came in AA. Now I don't want to go into his story because that will really make me sick for a while. I'll start getting miserable again. But today he's had 17 years of sobriety, so that's what counts. They're all gone. I'll get up to today. We've got to cut this up. You know, you go back in time, and when you're 75, you really go back. You know, you could sit here all day and hear what's going on. But to get up closer to today, I mean, I've got the four sons, and they're all married, and I'm a great-grandmother now. Great-grandmother, you. And I've got grandchildren up north. And it seems like we were talking about alcoholism running in the family. I got a grandson that's come into AA about a dozen thousand times. I hope one day he stays. But he's a sick kid. We're going to be moving over near them. They're all adults, of course, and middle-aged adults, baby boomers, you know. So, but they understand this program, too. They used to come to all our birthdays and all that. But any sense of accomplishment or anything in my life, I owe to this program. I owe to the people here. I often, once in a while, think about what would it be like if you never had it. I've probably been dead long ago without it. So I had people who gave me the sense of security and the sense of hope that I could amount to something. On that score, I like to talk about it. My big interest in sobriety that accomplished me, it was something that I dreamed of when I was a child, of being an artist. And I basically can do things alone a lot of times. So I took up painting. I started painting. And I wish I'd done it when I was a kid, because I started finally making some progress with it after painting for about 20-something years. And I couldn't believe that finally I was, you know, getting better. I don't look at it like my life career. It's an interest that I have. But I managed to get in some galleries, and I managed to sell. So that gives you some kind of a encouragement, you know. And I find a lot of peace with that. So, at any rate, I think that'll be the end of the story. So the next person can speak over here, and you'll be loved to hear from you. So I'm very happy today. Thank you.
Our next speaker is going to be Gay.
Thank you, Joy. My name is Gay Garner, and I'm an alcoholic. Yay. Grateful to be sober and grateful to be here. I have never considered myself an old-timer, and this is the first time I have ever been asked, even though I qualify years-wise, I guess. But anyway, when Pat called and asked me if I would share on the old-timer panel, I really thought he was kidding. And he assured me he wasn't, so I'm here because I don't ever say no when somebody asks me to do something for AA. I've been very emotional lately. I've just rotated off of being the Southeast Regional Trustee after 4 years of intense traveling and work. So there's a lot of emotional stuff going on with me with that. My daughter is here. She's has 7 months of sobriety, and Lori's very much a part of my story. I told her today I hope I didn't embarrass her, because I certainly would never want to do that, but I have to talk about her because she's very much a part of my story, as my whole family is a very much a part of my sobriety. And I just love being sober, and I heard something one time that really kind of puts me a little bit at ease. And I heard a gal say one time, she said, you know, we're not really speakers or lecturers, we're just storytellers. And I like that. That kind of gives me a feeling of relaxation, ease, and I'm just here to tell you the story of my miracle and what happened to me from the time that I came my time to come to through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came from a family where there was a lot of alcoholism, and we didn't know that's what it was, and we didn't call it that, but that's what I have learned today as a result of my coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and learning a little bit about myself. Not only has made me understand my background a little bit, but it's made me really understand the people who were in my background. It's offered me a lot of insight and an awful lot of forgiveness as a result of working the steps. I also want to thank all the speakers that I've heard. It's just really, I will always leave richer than I come, and I'm always so grateful. It's such an exciting thing to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think if I were asked to be what one of the most things that I'm most grateful for, it's I am so grateful the time in which I got sober. I got sober 21 years ago, and I got sober in a time when it seemed to me the people that were sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous were really grateful to be sober, were excited about being sober. You never left a meeting. Newcomers didn't talk a lot back then. We sort of listened, and we got to talk after the meeting, but we heard a lot of wonderful stories about AA and the miracles, and it was such an exciting time. And I got sober with people like Bill and with Pat W. and with Jan, and it just has been wonderful to look back. And you never left a meeting of AA that you didn't know that you were one of the lucky ones who had been given that opportunity to get sober while many people were dying on the streets in of alcoholism. And a lot of people in my family were dead as a result of alcoholism. And as I got sober my first year in the program of AA, I watched my father die of this devastating illness. He'd come to live with me and had been my drinking partner for years, and as I got sober I watched him die, and he died in withdrawal from alcoholism. I had a brother when I was 5 years sober at the age of 40 die suddenly as a direct result of alcoholism and drug addiction. I have another brother who is an alcoholic and has been hospitalized numerous times for alcoholism, and he continues to live that way. I've had an opportunity to share this program with him, and everybody in my family saw me get sober, so they know what AA did for me, but it was not, you know, to be of their choosing. And I guess one of the greatest gifts that you gave me in AA is when I got here, you said, you know, the greatest gift you can give your family is you stay sober and you work the principles of this program and you show them a better way. I have a husband who is very active in Al-Anon, and we both take our responsibility for taking a lot of sickness into our family for a very long period of time. But that's in the past, and we can't do anything about that, so today it's a different story. We take a lot of healing into our home and a lot of love and a lot of recovery and a lot of principles that this program has taught us, and certainly a different way of loving than we ever knew before. Al and I have, I guess Al would probably be what you would call in the big book a heavy drinker, which given the right set of circumstances does not drink anymore. And I sort of feel like I'm part of that right set of circumstances. And Al doesn't choose to drink today, even though he's an Al-Anon. And I'm very grateful for that. It just makes our family life easier. And he says it makes our family life easier. So anyway, I'm grateful for that. We have three children. The oldest one does not have an alcohol problem or any other. She has her own set of problems. And she's been to some Al-Anon meetings. And we've had an opportunity. One of our amends to our family is we talk a lot about the steps in our family. When people have problems, we always are able to sort of reference what we do in the steps to sort of offer them some sort of solution to their problem. So Julie's been through a very sad divorce, and she's had some custody situations and things like that. So we've really had an opportunity to talk to her a lot about the steps and how they work, and she's been able to do that. And she tells us all the time how grateful she is for us and how we have helped her so much get through her hard times. Lori has been in and out of the program of AA for 18 years, and her life certainly bears the brunt of this illness, and that's her story, but she is very much a part of my story. I'm very grateful. I'm a lot like Dawn. I waited many nights for that phone call, and she herself admittedly in a meeting the other night said that she was almost dead when she got here. So I'm really grateful that she's here with me today, one day at a time. Our youngest daughter has been in the program of Narcotics Anonymous for 5 years. She left home at the age of 15 with her and married her drug dealer, came back a full-blown drug addict, and shortly period of time after a lot of counsel with our AA friends, we packed her up in two green garbage sacks and put her on the street. So our life certainly does have a lot of active alcoholism still going on today. Lori's daughter, 14 years old, is in a treatment facility in Cobb County. She belongs to the state of Georgia as we speak right now. And she's been kind of hanging out with Bernard's grandson. So, you know, it just seems like the illness continues. And so it's very important for me to have recovery continue, of course, for my own sake and for those out there on the streets, and also for my family. As a kid growing up, I don't remember a lot of really unhappy times. I had a musical ability that got me into a lot of activities that I probably wouldn't have been in otherwise, so I was always forefront. It always seems like I had a lot of people in my life. As I'm able to look back now, I had a lot of people in my life, but I never had an interconnection with anybody. Left home at the age of 18 to go to New York and study music, which had been a dream that I had and my family had for me. And my family had a lot of money, and there were a lot of things that were made possible for me through this. As I look back, I was very dependent. I lived in a fantasy world. I read a lot of true romance magazines. This was about 42 years ago, and things were not in the open, and things were not talked about as they are today. So I was very innocent, and I went to New York seeking my fortune. And some things happened to me up there. I saw that as my first blaming board for what happened to me in my life. It appeared to me for many years that I was up there and I was successful and I was studying music and I was working, and my father came up and brought me home. Several years ago, some truth of that situation came to me. Truth has been sort of a very interesting thing in my life. It sort of evades me for a while, and then little by little, as I work the steps, I can come to the truth of what's going on. Anyway, I was in the jazz world. I had an opportunity to go to Juilliard School of Music and be in their entree jazz courses. I was working. I was thrown into the world of jazz where there was a lot of drugs and a lot of prostitution and a lot of stuff going on. And I found it necessary to call my mom and dad and share that with them back in Omaha, you know, thinking about all these exciting things that were happening to me in this world. And the next thing I knew, my father was in New York, and we had a nice little father-daughter chat, and I was to return home with him with the thoughts that, you know, this was not the kind of life I wanted to live, and he wanted me to go to school, meet a nice young man, live happily ever after, and I'd read all those true romance stories, and it really sounded good to me, so I returned home with him. The significant part in my life, I thought that this was why my life had not gone well, because I'd not been left in New York to pursue my career. But the truth was, alcohol became a regular part of my life when I was in New York. I had my first drink when I was in New York City, which was followed very closely by my first drunk. And alcohol became a regular part of my life. So as I look back, my life never went very well on a whole. It sort of had its ups and downs, but on a whole, it never went well. And I believe today that's because alcohol became a regular part of my life. It was the first time I had drank. I did not run with kids. I was offered alcohol at home all the time, but it was just not a part of my life. I came home. My dad had relocated to North Carolina, and I enrolled in Wake Forest College, which was run by the Baptist State Convention at that time. And there was not a lot of interesting things going on campus, but I fell right in with the four or five guys that drank immediately, of which Al was part of that group, and he was part of the kids that we began to sort of hang out in a little jazz thing and drink and listen to jazz, and that was sort of what our education was all about. I got pregnant, and this became my second blaming board. It was a terrible stigma for my family. It was a terrible thing for me to face back in those days. Things were not open like they were, and my mother and father were devastated. And I know today through this program that the things that were said back then were things that were said in moments of sadness and not knowing what else to do and not knowing how to handle it. But my mom told me I broke her heart, and my dad cried, and I mean, I was just devastated. I was not able to put that situation at peace until I was several years sober in this program through the steps. I carried that with me, and as I stand before you, I can relive that scene as if it just happened yesterday. But anyway, the marriage was arranged. I don't think Al and I were ever asked what we wanted or what we wanted to do. The marriage was just arranged, and we were married and scooted off to North Georgia in a little place called North Florida, a place called Stark, Florida, where we began our life together. And marriage was a disaster. This became my second blaming board. It seemed like I became obsessed with it. It became my compulsion to make this thing work. And it seemed like the harder I tried to make it work, the worse it got. And as time went on, it just got worse and worse and worse. Al and I had three children. Al was in radio and TV. We traveled a lot. Al had an opportunity to set up a series of radio stations for an entertainer throughout the United States. And he took the job, and our first move was to Knoxville. And there were some things that began to happen for me here at this particular time. I was 30 years old. I began to drink daily. That was the first thing that happened to me. I did not know how to drive an automobile, and I learned how to drive an automobile, but I had a terrible fear. I never drove over 25 miles an hour until I got sober. Never drove unless it was daytime and the sun was shining. It's just terrible fear. Terrible fear of the nighttime. Terrible fear of being alone at night. And Al reinforced all the locks on the door and the windows, and I began to daily drink at this time. I began on a series of things to try to make myself feel better as I'm able to look back at it through this inventory process. And I tried a lot of things. I tried a lot of churches. I felt like somewhere in my mind I felt like there might be an answer here. But I tried all the major ones, and I tried a few of the minor ones, and I never could seem to get anything going for me here. It was the time when all the self-help books began to hit the market, and I began to read all the self-help books. And the thing that I know about myself today is when I tried to make something work, if it didn't work in 24 hours, I was looking for something else to work. My sponsor was very quick to point out to me, too, that there's no first step in those things that I was looking at for my peace of mind. So I am firmly convinced today, until the drink is set down, there's no peace for me. The learning ability to learn anything is not there. So anyway, I continued just trying. I always had a weight problem, so there was always programs that I could go to here. I was just trying to find something to make me feel better. I was so devastated because this marriage was so bad. And the feelings of helplessness and hopelessness were becoming a regular thing with me. And of course, as I began to drink daily, the progression of alcoholism began to take place with me. My relationship with my mother had become very intense, I think, today, because I could not put that dependency on Al, and it had to go someplace. And it went right back to her, and she became my higher power. She became my one validity for my existence. And she and I had a very close relationship. She would come, and we would have some drinks together and listen to some music together and tell each other how important we were to each other. And that's the kind of relationship that I had with her. I got a call one Thanksgiving morning that she died suddenly, and my world just fell apart. And I thought for a long time that this is where I really crossed the line into the alcoholism, but I'd been there long before. By the time I got this call about my mother, I was already loading drinks. I was watering down booze. I was buying liquor by the half pint. I was hiding the booze. I was spiking my drinks. I was doing all these things. So I was way into the alcoholic drinking before this thing happened. My father sold his house in Florida and came to live with me. And my pattern until I came to AA was I had a box of letters from her, and I would read these letters and drink every night. The letters were basically about how she loved me. They were written to me when I was in New York, so they were. She died in 73, and these letters were written in 55. And I would read these letters. I would drink. I went to several seances trying to reach her. I went to the library and checked out all the books that I could find on how to reach people who had passed on to the other side, just feeling like maybe, you know, if I could get a hold of her, I'd be okay. That was to be my pattern until I came into AA. Some physical things began to happen to me. My hair all fell out. I got sores all over my body. I got swellings in my hands and my throat that were to lead me to a series of doctors to try to find out what was wrong with me. They all had a meeting with Al and I, and their conclusion was that I was having a nervous breakdown. And the doctor said to me, what's going to have to happen to you, Gay, is you're going to have to change. You're going to have to change the way you think and the way you act and react. Everything about you is going to have to change if you're going to survive this thing. And I asked him, I said, well, how do I do this? And he said, well, I don't know. You're just going to have to do it. So I left that doctor's office knowing that changes needed to be taken with absolutely no idea what to do. The significance for me in that is that when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what you told me had to happen. I had to change. Everything about me had to change. My thinking, my actions, my reactions, if I was going to live and be free of alcohol, plus all those other wonderful promises that were given of a life that's that we can attain through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So my life went on for a few more months. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been to Omaha, and a friend of my mother and dad's was 2 years sober, and he told me a little bit about his story, although I didn't identify much. Although I think I really did inside, I just don't think I knew that I had identified, because some of the things that he shared with me I remembered the night I called AA. I think that it was very much like it is in the 12 and 12. My bankruptcy was complete. I was so self-absorbed at this period of time with myself and my life that I couldn't think of much outside of it. I'd become very suicidal. I had Al was carrying large sums of money. He was in a lot of trouble business-wise. The FBI had our phone tapped. The IRS was a regular visitor at our door. Our bank accounts had been attached. They'd removed cars and all that kind of stuff had been going on because of the business that he was involved in. So I had a lot of legitimate fears. But anyway, I was sitting on the edge of the bed with a loaded gun getting ready to blow my brains out, because for me at that time, the unbearable life was just... I just could not imagine going on much longer. And so I think I had what that first step calls that act of providence, that intervention of God, or whatever it is that has to happen for us, happened for me that night. I put the gun down, and I went to the phone, and I called the central office number. They told me that they'd have somebody else call me back. And when they called me back, I'd passed out. I know there wasn't that much time, but I'd passed out. And one of the girls answered the phone and asked if they would call me back the next morning, and they did. And I was taken to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in January of 1976. I did not get sober. The miracle didn't really happen for me until March. I had my last drink on March the 14th. And it was just something that happened. I hadn't planned for it to happen. I felt for a lot of times I was kind of on a tightrope. Sometimes I felt like I was alcoholic and this is where I needed to be. And at other times I didn't feel like I was alcoholic. I was a housewife alcoholic. When I got sober in the east side of Atlanta, there were not many women around, and the few women's stories that I had heard were very bizarre stories, and my story had been simply, I drank alone at home, or when I drank out, I drank with my husband, so I didn't have a lot of bizarre outside stuff, even though the devastation and destruction and the hopeless and helplessness was going on inside. It was a wonderful time for me after I finally had my last drink. I had some interesting things happen to me. I was fixing myself a drink one night, and this was after the 14th of March, and I lifted up the glass, and the bottom of the glass fell out. And I just thought maybe that was a message from my mother. I had been trying to reach her for so long. And on two other occasions, I had poured a drink, and one of the gals in that area who'd just moved into that area from Texas called me and asked me if she could pick me up and take me to a meeting. I didn't drink on those two occasions. I was out with Al one night, and I ordered a drink. And he said to me, do you think you can handle a little something to drink tonight? Now, my family had absolutely no information on alcoholism or the alcoholic, so we had the preconceived ideas of the gutter drunk and the Salvation Army type stuff, so I didn't fit that category, so we were still not really sure what was going on, although Al would be willing to admit that I was far much better off not drinking than drinking. Anyway, he asked me if I could handle a little something to drink, and I said, yeah, and I ordered a drink. And she came back and said, they're all out of that. And I'd been drinking for 20 years, and they'd never been all out of that before. So I figured that was another message from my mother, and I didn't drink that night. The last experience I was to have was over the 4th of July weekend, and we had some friends down from Baltimore, and we were out, and I ordered a drink. And the barmaid brought the drink, and I couldn't touch it, and I started crying. I left the table, and I went in the restroom, and the girls came with me, and I knew in my innermost self at that moment. And as my dear friend Pat says, I knew there was no good drinking time left for me after that period of time. And, of course, wonderful things began to happen for me after that time as I began to get sober. Somebody told me about a little group called Clarkston, and it was a step meeting, and it was the only one in that end of town. There was one other step meeting, I think, that was in the inner city, Atlanta. And so I got to go to that step meeting, and I went there, and I heard the old-timers share about the steps and working the steps. And it was, as I said, a wonderful time. And once I knew in my innermost self that who I was and what I was and where I needed to be, all kinds of wonderful things began to happen to me, and I began to get sober. I got sent to North Atlanta to get a sponsor because there weren't any women with any time in that area. And she gave me two great pieces of freedom. The first was, she suggested I go home and pray, and I told her I was real sorry I didn't believe in prayer. And she said, well, that she didn't really care whether I believed in that or not, but that's what they had found that worked. And she said, I didn't have to believe it. She said, if you'll just go home and you'll do a few suggestions that we ask you to do, you don't have to commit to them, you don't have to believe them, you don't have to do anything. Just the only commitment you got to make is make a phone call before you want to take a drink. And that has always been a commitment I've made, that if I want a drink, I make that phone call. And then if I still want to drink, that's another story. But I have made that phone call on several occasions, and I have not found it necessary to take that drink. The other piece of freedom, she told me that I didn't have to believe, that I would just, if I could just do what they asked me to do. And of course, we all know what happens then. You do the action, and the belief follows. The other thing was that I was going to learn a lot of new meanings to a lot of old words I'd heard all my life. And I was really not feeling very smart. I didn't understand what they were talking about with love and sobriety and all those words I'd heard all my life, and I had absolutely no idea what they meant. And that was a wonderful piece of freedom that she gave me. There were no women that side of town, so when the 12-step calls started coming on, I had the wonderful opportunity of a lot of 12-step calls in those days. And my life just continued to get better as I worked the steps and got involved in AA. My service has been a remarkable experience. I was sitting in Clarkston. Lori had become a runaway. We didn't know where she was. We had the DeKalb County police on her. They found her. They picked her up. And I was sitting in that meeting. They asked me to read how it works, and I was boo-hooing. I couldn't get through it. And after the meeting was over, I was at the business meeting because, short of death, you always went to your group's business meeting back then. And Pat Wheeler asked me if I would put myself available to be the GSR. And I told him that I was real sorry I couldn't do that because I had too many personal problems and I would not be able to do service for AA. And he took me aside and talked to me about service and how good it would be for me, how good it would be for me, and how it would help me in the sadness of the personal things going on in my life. And, you know, I'm so grateful I believed him, and I told him I would do that. And that was the beginning of my service, and I had an opportunity to serve as the delegate of the state of Georgia and on to be the trustee for the Southeast and to share and experience that wonderful how it works at that level of service. And it has just been really, it's changed my life forever, the opportunity. I was at the World Service meeting this past time, had an opportunity to be with 46 delegates from 46 countries talking about AA. That's how far-reaching our message has been in 62 years. The fact that our language has been translated into 60 dialects and languages is just phenomenal. And to be a part of that and watch that work is just something that has just been wonderful for me. My relationship with my family, my relationship with Al, the divorce papers were on the table at 5 years of sobriety. I woke up one morning and I knew I didn't have to make it work anymore. And what a great freedom that was. And from the time I knew that I didn't have to make it work anymore, it started to work. And he went to Al-Anon. His life hit a bottom and he went to Al-Anon. And his life is as much a miracle as mine is. And we've been able to learn about a relationship, something we never knew, giving each other respect and space and support and all those things that he didn't know about it and I didn't know about it, but we know about it today, and it's been a great gift that's been given us. The other thing I want to share with you is that I'm a jazz musician, so I don't have to tell you where I have to go to work. And I tried to go back to work when I was first sober, and it didn't work out. It was just too much. And about 9 years ago, I had an opportunity to do it again. I had a lot of support from my family and the people I sponsor and my sponsors, and I went down, and I now work in Atlanta, and I've been doing that over these years. And I go in and I work in affirmation. That's God's territory that I'm in. And I'm there for a reason. I'm there to do what I'm supposed to do. And I will be forever grateful for you, not only for my life, but for what you have given my family. And I just thank you so much for letting me share in this.
not least, we have Bernard C. Come on up here, Bernard.
After gathering all the evidence, I found out I'm one of them real alcoholics who's very grateful to be sober. My name is Bernard Carter.
Hi.
It's an honor and a privilege to be here. And I want to thank Pat and the committee for inviting me to be a part of this celebration. I didn't know whether to be angry or be thrilled when he spoke about old timers group. reminds me, I asked my sponsor what he had to do with being an old timer. He says, don't drink liquor and live. Old timer means I've just been around this final fellowship since November 4th, 1974, and haven't found it necessary to take a drink. And sometimes I have to watch that and say I haven't found a good reason to take a drink, because I heard a fellow say that one time, so I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, and one of the fellows in the back says, well, you know, I saw that guy drunk last week, and he confronted him. I said, man, what are you talking about? I found necessary to take a drink since that some 15 years. He says, I saw you drunk last week. He said, I know that, but it wasn't necessary. So, I haven't found a good reason to take a drink. I've had a lot of excuses, thousands of excuses to take a drink since I've been sober, but I haven't found a good reason. And it's all because of this fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful. And for the people like Leroy, who's in my home group of Easy Does It, and I bring you greetings from that group, because he and two other people were very instrumental in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, my being here today. I wonder if he's following me, because ever since day one, this guy's been following me. Yeah. Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to share a little bit with you in a little while, let you know I qualified to be here. But I wonder why they always called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I kind of figured out that they knew that I didn't want you to know that I needed to be here. I wanted to be a secret from everybody. Yet everybody I knew I needed some help from somewhere. See, they knew that. I was always questioning who's going to be there. And one of the first people I saw when I came to the meeting was the lady I used to sing in the choir with at church. I said, Dagmar, what are you doing here? She said, the same thing you are, Bernard, trying to get sober. I says, oh, that was a spiritual awakening. I worked hard to get here, and I struggled long to stay away. Worked hard for many years to get here. Yet I struggled not to be here. What a phenomenon. I was searching for something. I was telling Leroy earlier about something he shares in his message when he shared is about, I was searching my soul, but yet my soul I could not see. I searched for God and for my brother man, fellow man, and they just kept eluding me, getting away from me. Yet I came to a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found all three. God, myself, and my fellow man, that I'm okay with today. Searched many years, because seeming though there was something always wrong with me, on the inside. Even before I picked up a drink, I just didn't feel okay with me. How can I be okay? I was searching how to get it okay over here. If I can just get this over here and this over here to be okay right here, then I'd be okay. But it just couldn't seem to get to fit the pieces to fit together. Something was wrong. I was full of irritability. You know, the big book talks about, and I was able to identify with that when it says we're irritable, restless, and discontent. Just didn't feel right. My brother and sisters, seemed to just fit in and do okay and interact with folks, and I just didn't seem to do that. Didn't feel good about me. I saw myself as the black sheep of my family. You say, you don't even get that, but that's all right. I just didn't seem to fit in. But yet I wanted to. I wanted to be a part of and be liked by folks. And I wanted to be a responsible person, a responsible husband. I just wanted to grow up like that. I was taught some principles as a kid growing up by my parents. But yet that seemed to just melt away, just go away because of this irritableness and this restlessness and this ease. And then I came to a fellowship and I began to study something and said I had an illness. I had a dis-ease. I said, wow. But I worked hard. I drank long enough and hard enough until I had enough. I struggled often early in recovery, and I run into people, some of them old guys I used to drink with, and they say, hey, Bernard, come on and have a drink, or go to a social function somewhere, and people ask me to have a drink, and I say, you know, I couldn't say, no, I tell them I'm an alcoholic. And so I just say, no, thank you, I've had enough. I've had enough. Because that's one of the things that my sponsors, old John F., said to me when he came to that apartment. That time is sort of fuzzy. Many things happened. Many things were said by these people who came, but yet there were certain things that just sort of stuck with me. And one of the things he asked me, he says, Bernard, do you feel like you've had enough? Do you feel like you've had enough? And I had to concede and say, yes, I've had enough. I remember reading in the big book, things just keep popping up, you know. You know, like God keeps putting people in your lives who's supposed to be there. And these three people were supposed to be there at that given time. And the big book said, in the chapter We Agnostic, it says, when you honestly find that you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely. Or if when drinking you find out that you can't determine the amount you're going to drink, you're probably alcoholic. And I fit both categories. Now, mind you, I didn't know what alcoholic was. Whatever it was, I felt it wasn't me. I remember my family, my mother particularly, talking about the evils of drinking. She knew about it firsthand because alcoholism ran throughout my family. My grandfather died as a direct result of alcoholism. My father was paralyzed from the neck down in his latter years, and it came as a direct result of drinking booze. He passed out and had an accident, and that's where it was. Had an uncle, loved him dearly, was a college professor. He committed suicide as a direct result of alcoholism. And all the thing I could hear growing up is, they got it. Oh, they got it. And I wonder, what is it? It was alcoholism. And mother told me about those evils of drinking booze, and I swear I'd never do that because I loved her dearly, and I would never go against her wishes. But it also says in the book, big book, there comes a time when we have no defense against the first drink. That defense must come from a power greater than ourselves. I knew nothing about that. But I remember growing up in this small town in Virginia, and I moved away from, went to high school, and my first encounter with alcohol was one Saturday afternoon when I got with those guys who lived in that dormitory and we went to the movies. Now, I was a kid, as I said, was irritable, restless, and discontent and full of fear as long as I can remember. But I remember going to that movie that day and they had some booze and I took some. And guess what? I didn't like the way it tasted, but I sure liked the way it made me feel. All those feelings that I had just seemed to melt away into the nothingness. And I said, I'm okay. For the first time in my life, I felt okay about me and about things. I felt okay on the inside. And I thought, this is the answer for life. Anytime I'm feeling this way, all I got to do is take me a drink. But guess what? One day it quit working. My filter got busted. It just didn't work anymore. There were many drunks between that first drink and the last one. Many. Many events that happened in my life. Too numerous to tell. But I'm grateful to be here today, fully clothed and in my right mind. For many days I wasn't fully clothed, and certainly I wasn't in my right mind. You know, there's a real difference between not drinking and being sober. Sober to me, as it says, is soundness of mind, as it says in the book. Soundness of mind. There were many days I wasn't drinking, but I had no soundness of mind. But my higher power restored me to sanity. Second step. Oh, I tried drinking. From that time on, and I wanted to have a career. I'd gotten married to my high school sweetheart, my first of three marriages. The other two marriages were ended in a divorce as a direct result of alcoholism. In the second one, I wasn't drinking, but alcoholism had affected the other person. My first one, there was the mother of my two daughters, who I loved very dearly, and I say very honestly, if I could have stopped drinking for my daughters and my mother and my wife, I would have done so. No question in my mind. But I didn't have the power to stop drinking. I married my high school sweetheart, and we had this, my first daughter, and I wanted to be a responsible father and husband, and I had gone to school, mortuary school, because that's what I decided I wanted to be, a mortician. And I went to school and I graduated and I came back to Virginia from where I was born, and I searched all over Virginia looking for a job in a funeral home, and everywhere I went people said, we don't need anybody here today. It says business is not good enough. We don't need you. I came very despondent and irritable, and went to Lynchburg, Virginia, and the guy told me there, he says, Bernard, says, I got a friend in Washington, D.C. He's got a funeral home. He's looking for somebody. We corresponded. I went there, and I was employed. I was hired, and that began when my alcoholism began to increase. Because I moved to the big city, at home, they called me Bernard or Bernie. When I got to the big city, they called me Mr. Carter, and I thought I had arrived. I not only I find out that I didn't just suffer from alcoholism, but I suffered from big shotism. I thought it was the greatest thing to come down the pike. And I had the booze to celebrate all of that time. Progressive illness that always gets worse and never gets better. Many incidents in Washington, too numerous to tell. Every time I drank, I didn't get in trouble. But every time I was in trouble, I had been drinking. And I had to take a look at that. Things happened to the point where I was fired from that job because early in my drinking career, I began to have blackouts. I just couldn't remember things that happened. Not passing out, but just couldn't remember what I was been doing or where I'd been or anything else. It began to affect my job and my family. And my boss began to tell me that, Bernard, I think you got a drinking problem. And he said, you better do something about it. And I say that because he had a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is about 1961, 62. He says, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a friend. He invited me to go, and I went for all the wrong reasons. And if you're new here this evening, Don't do like I did. I was there comparing myself with the people who were there. They identified the jails and the homes lost and jobs lost. And I said, those people need to be here. I don't. I couldn't identify the disease of alcoholism, and so I continued to drink. And my boss told me, if I ever catch you drinking on the job, it's over with. But I knew that with the hangovers I used to have, that I needed to find something that would help this hangover. And so the only thing I found out was another drink of liquor. It quieted my stomach, my nerves, and I had a terrific hangover one morning after I went to work at this, and I had this person that I had embalmed and dressed and put in the casket, and I brought my liquor to work with me that morning, swearing I'd never do that. But I knew I had to survive that day, and I brought my liquor to work, and I began to drink, and everybody had been out on the funeral service except my boss, and he was upstairs. And I began to drink, and I heard him coming down the steps, and I knew that I had to hide this bottle, because if he caught me, it was over. And I knew nothing else to do but work in the funeral business. And so I had to hide my liquor. Some of you have hidden your liquor in different spots. But I put this top on my liquor real quick and put it in the foot of the casket and just closed it up. And the boss told me to go down to the morgue and pick up a couple bodies, which I did. And when I got back, the fellas had gotten back from the funeral, and they saw this guy ready and all dressed and everything. They took him upstairs to the reposing room. My liquor's in the foot of the casket, so I got to figure out how to get it out. Well, if my sane thinking, I'll just get it out before they come in, the view. But they came in at a different hour, and so I couldn't get it out then. So the ideal time is to get it out at night when they go home and close up the funeral home. But one dear brother wanted to stay with Dad all night, and so I didn't get it out. So the ideal time is to get it tomorrow, next morning before funeral service time. My thinking, my sanity says that it's 11 o'clock service, but it's a Catholic service, 9 o'clock in the morning. I never did get my liquor out of that casket, wherever that guy is. Things went from bad to worse, you know, leading funeral processions and not knowing where you're going and people following you. And so the boss says, Bernard, you cannot tear down a business, because the word got around that I was good at my work, but the word also got around that I was a drunk. And he says, I'm going to have to let you go. And the only thing I could think about is, how dare this man do this? How can he do this to me? Doesn't he know how good I am? But he let me go. Very egotistical, very selfish and self-centered. And about that time, my first wife says, she cannot tolerate this. And she decided to leave. I decided this is not the place for me. At that time, I began to make the institutions, asylums, the jails in D.C. And I said, I need to move. And I went to Columbus, Ohio. It was the same thing there as it was in Washington. What I didn't understand is when I leave or move somewhere, I carry me with me and I carry my disease. And the same thing was happening. I'd been to Atlanta on a vacation, and I decided to come to Atlanta to live. My second wife at the time, because she made all the arrangements and got everything prepared, and she married me, and I was drunk on my wedding night, but she followed me here to Georgia. I got a job at the funeral home, which was short-lived, and I was fired from there. I began to make the jails here in Atlanta, and made several of them, but I had this individual who would always come and get me out. Until the last time. And the reason why she didn't get me out the last time, because she joined a program called Al-Anon. And I guarantee you, people say AA will mess up your drinking. Them Al-Anons will mess it up too if they're living right. And I called her and I says, honey, will you come and get me? She says, I can't do that. I said, why not? She says, because I'm not responsible for your behavior. I said, where'd you hear that mess? But that's the greatest thing that could have happened to me. Because when I was in that jail, they had an institution meeting there of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a fellow named Hank D. from the Rebos Club gave me a big book. And he wrote in it, says, Bernard, when you read this, I hope you find a message of hope. Warm regards, Hank D., March of 73. I told you my sobriety day was 74, which meant I had some more drinking once I got out of jail. My last drunk was one Sunday when I went to the bootlegger to get some booze, and I did, and nothing happened as I began to drink, other than I just got sick. And I crawled from the bed to the bathroom and began to throw up, and I pulled up in the mirror and saw what I had become, from a successful business person to absolutely nothing. I felt and looked horrible. I crawled back to the bed and I cried out the only prayer I know, and I was sincere, and I said, God, please help me. God, please help me. And I told my wife at that time to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful being an alcoholic because God put people in my life I never dreamed of, like John F. and Leroy and Big John. They began to talk to me, detox me. I had some orange juice and honey, and I had the shakes, and I had all that stuff. And they kept telling me it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. Not in my wildest dreams did I dream that it would be all right. No way. But when I was able to walk, was able to talk with any type of clarity, they said, let's go to meetings. And that's when I was introduced to Easy Does It group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't have a car, but they were so lovingly and caringly would pick me up. I remember one day in particular I began to feel a little better, and Big John had come to pick me up, and I would say, well, John, you know, I don't think I need to go tonight. And he says, shut up, Bernard, and get in the car. Let's go. After a while, you know, I began to feel something just like I felt this evening when I walked in the room and I met a first member here. Saw Fanny, and I got the same feeling when I saw her as I did and I began to get in that meeting when I first came. I'm at home. I belong here in this fellowship. There's a sweet, sweet spirit there, and I feel it every time I go to a meeting. What is it, my home group, or what is out of town? You see, it says in the big book, we come from every social, economic, religious, and political background, where people ordinarily would not mix, but yet there exists among us a camaraderie, a fellowship that is indescribably wonderful. I understand that today. Don't you understand about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous? They had to have a requirement that if I had to have a car, that I had to have a bank account, that I had to be of a certain race or color, I couldn't be here. But they said the only need is the desire to stop drinking. I didn't have to be sober, just the desire to stop drinking. I met that requirement. And slowly but surely, they loved me back to health where I could love self. Many things happened in between that to get me where I am today. I was unemployable, still irritable and restless, but I didn't find it necessary to take a drink because I had people like you around me to help me just one day at a time. When I ran into a difficult something happening, I'd go to John. He says, it'll be all right. And his ever answer was, go pray about it. I said, John, I don't want to pray about it. I want an answer. Everything will be all right. Well, you know, surely but surely, it worked out. It just did. Because I had a guide, something, guidelines to go by. I had some spiritual principles to go by. And that's what the 12 steps were about. And I was able to work those in my life. I've come to know a better life than I ever dreamed of. Many happenings in my life. Physical challenges since I've been sober. But the miracle of the power that's greater than self just continues to work one day at a time. See, I have a couple of grandchildren. As a matter of fact, I have three. The one Gail mentioned, and I have two other small grandchildren. And I almost missed it. Almost missed it. I'm married a third time now. Had no dreams of getting married again. I was just going to bachelor it out. But God put people in your life who were supposed to be there. And for the first time in a long time, I know how to have a relationship the program of recovery, 12 steps taught me how to live. And I didn't begin to learn how to live until I was about 41, 42 years of age. The program taught me that. And I'm okay with me on the inside today. And I have an opportunity now to know that the program works in different areas. Not just not drinking, but about living with other people, working with other people. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for you being here, because without you, I wouldn't be here. People like you. One of my old sponsors says in his closing, and I picked up on it, says, if you're looking for sobriety, may it please your God you find it. And if you have sobriety, may it please your God you keep it. For it's far easier to stay sober than it is to get sober. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Bernard. That was wonderful. All of you were wonderful. It makes me very grateful to be a part of this program and to know that maybe one day I might be an old-timer sometime. And I'm just so grateful to be a part of the program now, because as I've heard everyone share, I'm a little bit luckier, I think, because there's more meetings, there's more groups, there's more people, there's more help out there than there was when you guys came in. And I'm just so fortunate to be here and so grateful to be sober. And with that, I want to close the meeting, and I think Bernard's going to sing for us. So if you come up here and sing, and we'll all couple up out there.
If you just reach out and touch the person next to you, and let the Spirit just flow from heart to heart. And we close in a usual manner, in a unique manner, and say in a great prayer that's been given to us. You know, it's the Lord's Prayer. I've been fortunate enough to go back to sing some, not only in the fellowship, but I remember many times I used to try to sing in church and I'd be drunk. Not proud of that, but that's the way it happened. But the prayer that's given to us, and realizing in the consciousness of a power greater than ourselves that allows this all to be possible. And it's the Lord's Prayer. So in the consciousness of giving thanks to this power, let's close this meeting. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed would be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Go in peace today.